Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 39, featuring my earnest conversation with Dr. Carl Cohen, a nationally celebrated educator and my former superintendent in the Long Beach Unified School District. I'm honored to pay homage and reverence to a leader who's had such an impact on my life, both professionally and personally. On this episode, we discuss Dr. Cohen's inspiring life of service, the power of listening and leadership, and how to create systemic change wherever you are serving. The Freedom Writers and I are so excited about the 20th anniversary edition of our book, The Freedom Writers' Diary, which comes out on September 3rd. That same week, our new documentary, Freedom Writers, Stories from the Heart, will begin airing on PBS stations nationwide. Today's guest is woven into the tapestry of both our book and our documentary, and all the milestones that have made the Freedom Writers' journey possible. I'm eager to share more news with you about the release of the book and the documentary coming soon. Today, reflecting upon the past two decades, I'm unbelievably grateful for the influence our guest has had on our lives. Our unique Freedom Writer family would never have been possible without Dr. Carl Cohen, who believed in our movement since the very beginning and allowed us to stay together for all 4 years at Wilson High School. Within Dr. Cohen's story, there are countless examples of leadership and love that we want to share with you today. His journey to become a superintendent was unconventional, but this unorthodox path prepared him with a passion for listening to those whom he serves. Together, we delve into the experiences that influence the kind of leader Dr. Cohen has become. With wisdom and tenderness, he provides practical and inspirational advice for you, no matter where you are currently serving. You don't have to be a teacher to learn from his invaluable leadership lessons. I hope this episode leaves you feeling empowered to create meaningful change in your life and use the power of listening to lead others effectively. Thank you so much for tuning into our podcast. Now, here's my conversation with the esteemed educator, Dr. Carl Cohen. Was a brand new teacher. I was blessed to be at the Long Beach Unified School District. At that time, it hosted about 97,000 students. And that superintendent was Dr. Carl Cohen, who was celebrated around the country, if not the world. So when I'm with him, I'm still that young teacher. I'm still insecure, dotting I's, crossing T's, and trying to prove that I know what I'm doing, even when I don't. So I want to start before you were this world-renowned educator, before you were a power player in education. What was it like to be a young boy in Long Beach?
Sure. I grew up basically in 1950s world of Roman Catholicism. I didn't go to public school. I went to St. Anthony's, which was the large parochial school in downtown Long Beach. And I went off to St. Anthony's as a first grader, coming from a single-parent African-American household living in poverty. And I encountered Sister Mary Martin, an Immaculate Heart sister, who taught me to read in the first grade. Most of the parochial schools in those days didn't have kindergarten, so your first encounter was the first grade. And Sister Martin was known for two things: teaching kids to read and getting them squared away in terms of discipline of a Catholic education experience. And she was remarkable in that she delivered on both. I remember we would come back from lunch each day, and she would tell us to put our heads down, and she would read us Winnie the Pooh. Not a picture book, but straight up A.A. Milne. And I would sit there and think, if I could figure out how to do this on my own, my life would be good. And somehow, I learned how to read in the first grade, like all the other kids who came from more advantaged two-parent households. And I think that single experience absolutely made all the difference in my life. The two most important things that I did as a youngster, I became both an altar boy and a paper boy when I was 10 years old. And those two experiences were the first signs of some leadership potential. I delivered the LA Times in downtown Long Beach. For that, I was paid $30 a month, which for a 10-year-old in the 1950s was a nice sum of money. In today's economy, it was worth $271. So that provided me, a poor kid, with pretty much everything that I needed and taught me responsibility. I set my alarm for 4:30 in the morning each day. I was at my paper corner at 5, 365 days a year, no days off for illness or vacation. So that, and being an altar boy, it was no surprise that at the end of eighth grade, I decided that I wanted to be a priest and went off to begin studying to be a priest at age 13.
In a home that was devoid of a father, what was that like to look to the priest, to look to the paper route, to look to the teacher to learn some of those values?
So a very traumatic thing happened in my home. I was probably 2 years old. My mom and dad had a confrontation, and my dad ended up fracturing my mom's skull. He hit her in the head with a hammer, and she ended up being taken to St. Mary's Hospital in downtown Long Beach, received the last rites of the Roman Catholic Church. Fortunately for me and my five siblings, she survived. And again, extraordinary trauma. My parents ended up, the Catholic Church at the time didn't allow divorce, and so they ended up legally separated for the rest of their lives. I didn't really grow up thinking the fact that I didn't have a father in the home was somehow detrimental, because there were all these substitute fathers around and available. One of the things about 1950s Long Beach, there were all kinds of things available to a poor kid. So in addition to baseball team, I got free membership to the downtown YMCA. There was a legendary, iconic Long Beach figure there, George Shorty Kellogg, whose whole mission in life was to build character through sports. And he was another father figure. If you were poor, you got to go on Navy ships on the holidays and have a meal with the sailors. Those kinds of things were all available. YMCA, the Catholic Boys League, baseball teams. You know, I loved playing baseball. Our coaches were once again sort of character building father figures. There wasn't much of an option for me in terms of choosing negative. The whole culture around me was all about, you have to grow up and be a decent citizen and make a contribution that is significant. I didn't have some of the things that, as I've gone around the state of California, talked to people in prisons who absolutely could not get to school in South Central Los Angeles without joining a gang. I did not have that kind of an experience growing up in what was called Iowa by the Sea back in the 1950s.
So do you think that led you to a life of service and humble service through education?
Yes. I grew up thinking that you've been given so much. It instilled in me a powerful sense of duty that if ultimately I wasn't going to be a priest, I had to go out there and do something else of valuable service to make a difference. And I actually left the seminary in November of 1968, months after Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy had been assassinated, and days after Richard Nixon had been elected president of the United States. And I felt it was critically important that I go out and do something valuable in terms of answering Robert Kennedy's call to make a difference on the urban scene. And so I walked into the personnel office of the Compton School District, and they looked at my transcript and said, "I see you have a bachelor's degree in philosophy. Do you think you could teach Western civilization?" And I said, "Of course I can," because I needed a job. I was probably the single worst prepared teacher to ever walk into a public school classroom. I knew nothing. I had never attended a public school. The whole experience was quite extraordinary in that I did things probably borrowed from parochial school, and the students complained to the principal because I gave them homework on the weekends, and I had no idea that you don't give homework on the weekends. And I did other things that sort of branded me. I tried to keep an athlete after school on game day, and I'll never forget the young man saying to me, "You can't keep me after school because I have a game today." And I said, "You misbehaved today, so I'm going to keep you after school today." And he said, "Just wait, Mr. Parrish, the assistant principal and athletic director, is going to come out here and tell you that you can't keep me after school today." So Mr. Parrish comes out and he says, "Mr. Cohn, we appreciate the stand that you're taking with regard to behavior, but if you could let him go today, he could serve his suspension some other time." If I were heroic and a liar, I would say that I stood my ground and kept him after school, but I didn't. I let him go. But I took a vow that if I were ever in charge, there would be standards for all kids, including athletes, and that they would have to abide by those standards.
What I love about our stories, it's your story as well, it's featured in the book and the movie and now the documentary, is how difficult the 90s were for urban Los Angeles. You were a superintendent in the midst of a riot, the Los Angeles riots, after the Rodney King verdict was announced. What is that like to be a superintendent in charge when there is chaos?
In terms of the timeline, I actually was an area superintendent when the riots happened. I was also in charge of the district's anti-gang task force. And the superintendent announced that he was retiring. And so the search was underway for a new superintendent. What also happened at the time, the superintendent's father had passed away. And so he was on a few days of bereavement leave when the riot actually hit. So in my role as the area superintendent responsible for Poly High School and its feeder schools and also head of the anti-gang task force, I was sort of thrust into the limelight of dealing with this critical issue unfolding in the school district. So 2 months after the Rodney King riots, I was appointed superintendent. And if you look at my career path, my trajectory, it wasn't a traditional path to the superintendency. It was school counseling. I had never been a school principal. I didn't really have a reputation in terms of instructional leadership. It really was all about if social chaos is going to be the order of the day going forward, who is likely to restore order?
But I think that in that chaotic moment, hundreds of people lost their lives in the early 90s. Buildings were burning in your very city. And that tactical alert of young people, whether it was coming from the Springdale housing projects or the Carmelitos housing projects, navigating their way to school in the midst of chaos, and you coming out of that chaos, keeping everything intact.
Sure. It was an incredibly difficult time. And, you know, while the horrific events that were televised in Los Angeles got a lot of attention across the country and across the world, one of the most horrific crimes was committed in Long Beach near Central Park. A white youngster was pulled off a motorcycle and shot in the head and killed, but the TV cameras weren't running. There were horrific levels of violence that went beyond the Los Angeles core. I'll never forget riding with the school board members, seeing this burning hulk of a building that had been the Department of Motor Vehicles in Long Beach. So Long Beach and its urban core was very much a part of the rioting that went on in the spring of 1992. And I think as the leader of the anti-gang task force, I had spent an extraordinary amount of time with local law enforcement, especially the juvenile officers. Spent a lot of time in tennis shoes, jeans, a windbreaker, and a walkie-talkie, communicating, listening, talking to gang members. The objective was to keep the Long Beach schools free of gang violence. And so toward that end, I was asked to put together this anti-gang task force, and I ended up hiring some ex-gangsters. There's no better way to really get at the culture than to actually have people who know that culture and have been there on your team. And so it was an incredibly interesting adventure, and one that went a long way toward sending this message that Long Beach as a school system wasn't going to be overrun with gangs. When I see the discussion today, I would say to a lot of people, communities like Long Beach were under extraordinary threat. The businesses were leaving. The Navy had abandoned Long Beach. McDonnell Douglas, the largest employer in the community, employing 40,000 people, was leaving. And so there was this real question mark about would Long Beach survive as a community, or would it become this urban hellhole that no one would want to live in or have their kids in schools? And so there was a lot that was done to address those kinds of concerns. And I think today's environment is very different from that.
One of the things that's so disheartening for me as a teacher is school shootings, be it a Columbine, a Parkland, how kids are nervous now about their safety. I remember as a child, I did fire drills. I did earthquake drills because we're here in California. Now they have the quote-unquote bad guy drill. As a superintendent, what is that like to give advice to people who have power, knowing that someone with an AK-47 can walk into a school because they have, and they do?
I think there's a tremendous amount of concern as the school year starts. I always felt that school safety, you can never spend enough time on that. And so while the demands are many with regard to the superintendency, you've got to bump up test scores, you've got to do all this other stuff, I would argue that safety absolutely is priority one, that you will never get to all of those other things if you're compromised on those kinds of issues. And so actually having plans that make sense, incredibly important part of the work. And I think it's important that the superintendent actually participate in that to show leadership. I don't think it's just a question of having a school district police force, that sort of thing. I think you need to bring your personal leadership skills and make sure that everyone understands that you see safety and security as job one. I think we're at a point, given the events of the past week or so in America, that we're going to have tremendous anxiety as school opens this fall. And it's a fundamental duty, starting with the President of the United States, to keep the American people safe. And so any leader who isn't focused on that in the chain of command has defaulted as a leader. And it's going to take action on everyone's part to make sure that this situation is addressed. Sometimes I wonder what it will take in terms of why aren't we all marching in the streets for gun safety all across the country. There's no bigger failure for adult leaders than to make school children feel that they're unsafe at school. So everybody needs to get off the dime and needs to get out there and address this problem in a sustained way. All of the other industrialized countries, ours is the only one that's accepting this mayhem on a daily basis. And it's absolutely a stain, a black mark on our country, and something that we absolutely have to demand in terms of our leaders at every level.
What I admire that you did as a leader was intentional integration, intentional inclusivity. And that is not easy when people don't want to integrate. You know, Long Beach was in flux. You realized in order for this city to survive, I have to not only integrate busing, but I'm going to enforce busing. And I'm going to get kids of different shapes and sizes sitting together in the same school and the same classroom when that is not the norm.
What the Long Beach Board of Education did was they did not want federally mandated busing from the government. They wanted a local voluntary solution. And so that was what Long Beach was about. But some of the things that were extraordinary about what Long Beach did that no other community did, basically the Board of Education said to parents, if you want an all-gifted program for your child, you will come to Long Beach Poly High School for that.
For our listeners, at that time, Long Beach Poly was centrally located in a community that had the largest African-American population.
Right. And so basically, Long Beach put a lot of resources behind a voluntary integration program that ultimately served the school district well. If you look at comparable communities who were struggling with these issues back when, most of those communities have ended up being largely one-race minority schools. And Long Beach still has tremendous diversity in their schools, and it's a legacy of voluntary school desegregation program.
I had the kids who didn't get the pass, didn't get the book, didn't get the field trip, and I had to come to you with hat in hand and say, my kids want to meet the woman who saved Anne Frank. My kids want to go to D.C. First and foremost, what let me in your office? And then what made you say yes?
in my path before the superintendency, I was a school counselor. And so those listening skills that I learned, I brought to the position. And so listening to the struggles of a classroom teacher was incredibly important if you're going to improve the school system. And so for me, it was natural to sit down with a teacher that had requested an appointment with me. It's a large system, as you mentioned. It's approaching 100,000 students. And so the only way someone in charge of a bureaucracy that big is going to get honest, legitimate feedback is by actually listening to people who want you, as the superintendent of schools, to know something about what they're experiencing. And it made me very much aware of how important it was to listen to teachers. So you're wanting an appointment and coming to see me was the type of thing that I was very much open to and wanted to hear directly from classroom teachers about what they were experiencing. If the system at the time had been run well, the administrators at Wilson should have taken care of everything that you needed. But I think it would be naive, given what we know about large urban school systems, to think that that's automatically going to happen.
A funny aside is you went with us to Washington, D.C. I'm taking 150 16-year-olds, like chaos personified. And on our vigil from our hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue with U.S. Secretary of Education Richard Riley, we joined hands, we walked across Pennsylvania Avenue, we circled the Washington Monument, and the cops show up. And the cops see this motley crew of teenagers of every race and creed. And you helped us not get arrested. You helped us not spend the night in jail, and you gave us a voice because you were that authority figure. For you to be with us, with Freedom Riders, holding hands, singing songs, what was that like to understand what the outside world saw? They just saw skin color.
Like anything, superintendency is a hard job, and you can get removed, you can get distant, you can get jaded. And what the Freedom Riders gave me was a sense of purpose and value about what we were doing. And so if you look at anything from a liability insurance point of view, you're probably...
I must have been terrified.
You're probably not going to go on a field trip to Washington, D.C. But the bottom line is, superintendents, we need to feel inspired. We need to be moved by what heroic teachers are doing in the classroom. And any engagement with real students is incredibly valuable for the leader of a school system. So I never saw it as that big a deal that I was given an opportunity to actually go on a field trip with students, even though it was across the country. By the time the Freedom Riders were holding sway, I was probably 6 years or so into the superintendency, and I think we all need to be renewed around getting back to the core of why you're in this business and why it's 24/7. So the Freedom Riders did as much for me as I did for them. And I'll never forget going to the Lincoln Memorial at night and looking up and seeing Abraham Lincoln's words and feeling, you know what? You can do something incredibly valuable. And these young people and their teacher can inspire you to avoid burnout and all of the other things that can happen to a superintendent. The other thing that was so valuable that may be lost today, Dick Riley, Janet Reno, Bill Clinton, President of the United States, They came to affirm what we were doing in Long Beach, rather than we're going to go out there and tell those local school systems what they ought to be doing. And I think that's lost. Long Beach's success at improving student achievement had not kicked in when Dick Riley, Janet Reno, and President Clinton came to Long Beach. And so I think it's a huge object lesson for the rest of the country about the importance of what leaders can do to encourage people at the local level to do the right thing rather than constantly, in a top-down way, telling folks what they ought to do. And I'm forever grateful to Dick Riley. From my point of view, he's the best Secretary of Education that we've ever had, precisely because he was a good listener and he was looking for those things across the country where people were doing good work.
What I loved about you as a leader, you cared about us doing a good job professionally, but you really cared about us personally. And I want to share with our listeners that you had a really wonderful bond with my father, whom my students called me Miss G, so they named my dad Papa G. But when I tragically lost my dad, and I was in fetal position on my first Father's Day, you called me and you said, I'm going to take you out to brunch. And you saved me. So I want to thank you for seeing me as a professional, but also somebody who was struggling. It's a terrifying thing to be so vulnerable to a person of power and a position of authority. So I thank you for allowing me to, in my vulnerability, to have that relationship with you, that things were going to be okay.
We all have a story, and your dad was a very, very special person. And so, yes, I realized that first Father's Day without him would be something that was just a very emotional time. And I think getting to know employees, getting to know their story. We all have a journey to leadership, and I think knowing and responding to what people value becomes an important part of the job. So I was happy to be available, and I'm glad that it helped you through a difficult day.
So what was that like for you as someone who needed the results in a school district when an ordinary teacher had some extraordinary students who were actually able to publish a book?
Yes. One of the stories that I tell is about going to New York with the Freedom Riders and walking up to Doubleday, the book publisher, and seeing that big sign saying, Doubleday welcomes the Freedom Riders. And my reaction was, you can talk about standardized tests till the cows come home, but here is a major New York publishing house saying, these kids are writers and we want their story. That is a performance-based assessment in the real world that is much more powerful, much stronger than any standardized tests that the nerds can develop.
What I honor about Long Beach Unified School District is the reflection of that African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child. And I think for the children that I was blessed to teach, it was the village. There were so many programs that Long Beach provided for them. You allowed for my kids to have the first and sometimes only meal of the day. If they got to school early, they could have that hot breakfast with dignity. They could have that lunch. There could be that after-school program. There could be transportation to and from that project. They could start over if they were that foster kid taken away from a parent. You provided uniforms to say, I want to take away that gang affiliation. you provided single-sex academies for young girls to say, I'm good at math and I don't want to be held behind because I'm not a boy. So you did a lot of really innovative things to make the village compete with a lot of the other wealthier villages or affluent communities. How can other superintendents around the globe learn from those innovative things that you took risks implementing?
I think it's all about believing that you at the local level can do great things. And this is why I so value Governor Brown. Governor Brown basically said, you know what? The feds and state capitals, since No Child Left Behind, have had their shot at trying to improve things from afar. If we're ever really going to rescue kids who historically have been underserved, it's going to be done by those closest to them. And so while he, as a former student for the priesthood, framed it as the principle of subsidiarity, that if given the right resources and supports, people at the local level can, in fact, get it done. They don't have to rely on ever higher levels of government, including state capitals and the feds, to do valuable, important, and heroic things. And so that's been one of the real exciting things about my career after the superintendency, working in state government and policy making to actually get this message to people who've become jaded about, let's just figure out what Sacramento wants. Let's just figure out what Washington, D.C. wants. Let's not risk anything in terms of trying some things at the local level. And again, that was the beauty of the 90s. Often, when we started out doing something, the advice was, you can't do that in the public schools. You can't require uniforms. You can't separate boys and girls. You can't have this required summer school for kids that aren't reading at grade level. A lot of you can't, when in fact, you actually can. And I think that was the thing that really made a difference. We were determined to come up with solutions at the local level. The other thing that's sometimes neglected in the conversation is the power of Board of Education members who are focused on the right kind of support and help. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that the Long Beach Board of Education was absolutely stellar on that front. What do you need to be successful, and how can we as leaders work with you to make sure that we rescue as many kids as possible? And I sometimes, in traveling across the country, that type of thing, you don't see that kind of support. And I think it's another huge flag in the ground that's positive for Long Beach and what happened here.
You are what a humble servant looks like, a servant leader looks like. So what does good leadership to you look like to somebody who's going down that path to be a leader?
I think the most important thing that you can do in almost any leadership role is listen carefully to the needs of those that you're serving. And so when I've gone on to be a faculty member in higher education, whether USC, Claremont, GW, Harvard, it's all about listening and making sure that whatever you're delivering is relevant and what young people, the next generation of school leaders, actually need. One of the things that I tried to do was to give the entire school district an opportunity for employees to interact with the superintendent. So I had this thing called Cookies with Carl, where any employee who wanted to come and talk to the superintendent could. And I found it very invigorating in terms of hearing firsthand from people who were affected, how is this going? And are there things that we're missing that you feel the leader of the organization needs to know? And so Cookies with Carl became a staple of hearing what people in the trenches were actually feeling and thinking about what we were doing. And over time, it became something where people looked forward to this Cookies with Carl thing. I always worried about whether or not the tofu and jicama people were going to come after me for promoting cookies, but our school district cookies were outstanding. But I would argue that those skills really made all the difference in terms of influencing my leadership style. Listening, listening, and more listening.
I love that you're a Socratic leader, and you've always been that. And I think that gave me the freedom not to teach to a test, but to teach to a student. So I'd love for you to picture a kid in some classroom now who never thought that they could be a teacher. Maybe they were that first grader listening to Winnie the Pooh like you, or maybe they were the young kid in seminary. What advice could you give to someone who was young, someone who was poor, someone who might have faced great tragedy? How can education equalize an unfair playing field?
I think if you go back and sit down everyone who grew up poor and disadvantaged in the traditional sense, and you ask them what made the difference, education is going to come up and be identified as the thing that absolutely made the difference. And not only in my own life, but when I talk to others who grew up poor, they all talk about how a particular teacher inspired them, some program. I think sometimes the value of after-school programs are neglected. I think that's a critical factor in terms of where youngsters spend time. And so I think that that, more than anything else, is what the real difference maker is. And when you make that your life's work, I can't imagine anything more important in someone's life than that kind of making a difference.
In a school district of 100,000 kids, there's a lot of corners. There's a lot of dark spaces. But under your leadership, there was a lot of light. So what is the light? What is the lesson? And what is the leadership for kids in other school districts to find the light?
I think creating a space for youngsters who can actually give voice. The student voice is something that's incredibly important. Again, Governor Brown, in this effort to return control at the local level, talked about the value and importance of engaging students, parents, those that we often leave out of the discussion. So as I sat there for 4 years on the State Board of Education, I was most interested in what students had to tell us about the policies that we were adopting. And I think student voice is so valuable and so important. It's one thing to talk about what you want to do, but it's quite another thing to actually hear from a youngster on the things that make a difference. One of the things that the legislature has under consideration right now is the whole issue of what time school is going to start. And so there's a bill in the legislature that would mandate that middle schools and high schools could not start any earlier than 8:30 in the morning. And there's research from pediatricians and others about sleep-deprived teenagers. So a couple years ago when this bill was first being considered, I was out in the Victor Valley High School District, and I was having a forum with high school students, and I told them what the state legislature was considering, and they laughed and said, "Oh, great, we'll just stay up an hour later." And so I think it's important to actually hear from the youngsters when you're considering a policy change or something that's designed to make their life better, to actually hear from them firsthand about whether or not this scheme that the adults have come up with, whether or not it will really make a difference in their lives. And I have tremendous respect for researchers and for pediatricians, but if the youngsters aren't actually going to get more sleep, then making sure that school doesn't start any earlier than 8:30 probably isn't going to make a difference.
So in closing, what would be your advice to the leader in all of us to follow in your footsteps to be those humble servant leaders?
As I think about the message that I want to get out in the book that I'm planning, which is about leadership lessons learned, the most important one is lead no matter what your assignment is. Too often, we pay too much attention to formal positions and formal authority, when in terms of the real world, informal authority is probably the most valuable. You had very little formal authority at Wilson High School, but the truth is you were the most important teacher on that staff. And I think that's what we need to impart to everybody. It's not about an elected department chair or who's the head of the faculty council. It's all about who's making the biggest impact with students who historically have been underserved and we claim we care about. That gives you all the power and authority that you're going to need. So leading, no matter what your formal title is, no matter what your assignment is the most important message from me.
I'm eternally grateful to Dr. Cohen for being a model of effective leadership to all of us and for being a fundamental part of the Freedom Rider family for all these years. My dear listeners, may we use the power of listening to become an effective leader. May we engage directly with those we are leading. And like Dr. Cohen, may we all lead a life of service to improve the world around us. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for a special announcement on August 26th about our new edition of the Freedom Writers Diary and the national PBS launch of the Freedom Writers documentary, Stories from the Heart. In conjunction with the launch, we'll be unveiling a special podcast miniseries celebrating the 20 years since the book was first published. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruo. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.